How much should I talk about serial killers?
What?
Not a lot. Okay, I read a lot about serial killers recently.
I mean, we can do whatever.
How much should I talk about Vaporwave? So, like, a lot?
Greetings, and welcome back to Zero Credits, the show where we talk about things. My name is Henry.
And my name is John.
And together we're Henry and John.
Nice.
We're alone this week.
Nice intro, though.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, we don't have nobody.
So it's just all of our attention is focused on you, dear listener. What's going on in your life?
We can't hear them, is the thing, though.
You're right.
They're a really bad special guest.
I did not think this through.
They're like a special guest with a million heads, but none of them can talk to us.
It's like a Hydra.
Well, maybe more like 12 heads.
Hydras have heads.
I have no idea how many people listen to us. How many heads are Hydras supposed to have?
I think they start with like 2, and then for every head that's cut off, another one springs up like a Hydra.
Oh, is that how it works?
Yeah.
Okay. So did they start with one head, then when that was cut off, it split into 2?
I suppose, unless you've seen a Hydra hatch from an egg, we'll never know.
What if there were other kinds of Hydra?
Like feet Hydra?
No, like a Fibonacci Hydra, where it's like one head, then 2 heads, then 3 heads, then 5 heads, then 8 heads, then 13 heads.
That might be true.
Fibonacci Hydra. Look it up.
Although he sounds Italian.
Yeah, he is.
So, I don't know. Hydras, I think, were just Greek.
Oh, okay.
Greek.
I was confused with your traditional Greek pronunciation of the word Greek.
Thank you. I've practiced.
You took all those classes.
Yes, of Greek pronunciation.
Mm-hmm. You didn't learn Greek, just how to pronounce it.
Exactly. I don't know what the words mean.
Yeah.
Other than Greek, which is obviously Greek.
Obviously Greek.
All right, none of that was true.
Most of it wasn't.
Yeah.
I like to think that Fibonacci Hydra really exists.
I'd like to think that Hydras really exist, John. I'd like to think that Hydras really exist.
Hail Hydra.
Exactly. Speaking of that, do you catch that little thing on the internet?
Which
like
one?
A week ago? 2 weeks ago? Maybe a month? I don't keep up.
Enlighten me.
Apparently, people were outraged because some writer decided to end a Captain America issue with a secret reveal.
Oh yeah, I did see that.
It was revealed that he was working for Hydra the entire time.
Okay, let's not talk about whether or not that's a dumb twist or not, because I think we all know the answer to that.
Obviously, this is the greatest thing that ever happened to comic books.
Obviously. But also, what a bad sleeper agent.
Yeah, because, like, everybody knows him?
Everyone knows him. He has been foiling their efforts for, what, 70 years?
It depends on how far back this latest canon timeline starts.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, ostensibly, he's been fighting Hydra for the entirety of his existence.
Mm-hmm. That, seems like kind of a, I want to say a cash grab, but that's not, it's like exploitative.
It's, what can we do to shock people, to make them talk about our book, and now we're doing Civil War 2.
Are they?
Yes.
Oh.
And they're calling it, literally, Civil War 2.
Well, that just mirrors the real-life historical event of the Civil War 2.
Yeah, I remember that.
You know, the War of Midwest Aggression.
Where North Dakota and South Dakota finally split ways and fought for, like, a week.
It was a real shame.
Yeah.
As far as sequelized wars go, a real disappointment.
I mean, you can't really live up to the original Civil War.
Yeah, I mean, the original Civil War, it was mwah.
Oh my god.
Perfect.
All right, all of that was said in jest.
Yes, of course. But
they are actually doing a comic book, Civil War II, and it's like, I don't know, Iron Man versus some guy who I don't know.
Oh, what's his name?
I don't know. I didn't recognize him on the cover.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't either. So, are they going to do the same thing they did with the first Civil War?
I think it's something about, like, someone who's not S.H.I.E.L.D., who's not affiliated with any of the heroes, has created, like, a force of robots to enforce justice, and nobody should trust this guy. The Sentinels program.
Okay.
It's so the Sentinels.
No one should trust the robots?
Well, the guy who made the robots.
That doesn't sound like a civil war. That sounds like a war against robots.
No. There are people who are like, yes, these robots are good and friendly, and they're going to do great things.
Oh.
And there are others who are like, no, the Sentinels.
Yeah, I could see that. See, I was worried they'd do what the original Civil War did, where they come up with a really, like, interesting and engaging premise for it, and real, honestly, like, politically and philosophically interesting reasons to choose a side, and then just turn it into pointless McCarthyism and, like, black and white morality and make one side the obvious one that viewers should side with.
Yeah, you mean the whole, like, secret identity versus non-secret identity thing?
Yeah,
the
first one? What a huge waste of a great idea.
I mean, yeah, it was a really great idea. I love the philosophical, like, conceits and all of the, like, debates before the fists started flying, and then it just became sort of like, oh, Iron Man's wrong for a reason.
Yeah, the first few issues into the Civil War arc were really good.
Yeah.
Like, they made you question this, like we've talked about on the podcast, superheroes are American mythology. It made you question the righteousness of putting your faith in these mythological creatures that are capricious like Greek gods.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, they had to remember that they are comic books.
Yeah.
And comic books have to fall into there is a wrong and a right.
Do they have to?
Except for Watchmen. Usually,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. More often than not, they end up doing that, and that was such a shame that the writing took such a downward turn there at the end. Not the end. Near the, like, about the middle.
Yeah.
Where it just became, oh, people who are pro the Registration Act, they're just this really sloppy parallel to like McCarthyism when it came to communism. That's like, oh, this is dumb.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
I mean, it's not as though villains have to register, so what's the point, really?
Yeah.
We're just making it so that we're easier to be targeted in our everyday normal lives.
Mm-hmm.
Because the villains can just remain secretive.
Mm-hmm.
Although, the best villains are the ones that are very open about who they are, like Victor Von Doom.
Mm-hmm.
Dude rules a whole country, doesn't hide the fact that he's Dr. Doom. I mean, that leads you to pretty interesting territory. But I guess you can't have every villain do that, because then you have a bunch of Dr. Dooms running around with full power and whatever.
One of the more interesting things that the Civil War brought up as an idea was if you were pro-registration, you would effectively be part of, like, a governmental, almost non-governmental entity. That it would essentially be the Avengers with hundreds of members.
Okay, so Justice League Unlimited.
Yeah, sure. The idea that you have this huge number of superheroes fighting for a common cause with, like, centralized leadership was an interesting idea.
Yeah, and that can probably work. See the Justice League, or the Justice League America, or the Justice League International.
Or Young Justice.
Also that. That's a good show.
Young, never seen it.
I recommend it.
Really thinking about putting more superheroes in my life lately.
Well, it's that time of the year where we have one taste of superhero and then we want more.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the summer, and both summer and superhero start with S.
True, and also there's nothing good in the summer, so you might as well like things that aren't.
Yeah, I mean, it's also you've got, like, more time during the summer because we're all horrible people and we don't have jobs.
Yep, tell me about it.
I'm a horrible person and I don't have a job.
I'm also a terrible person. I hate my job. Anyway.
Anyway, let's not get into that. Let's talk about... Hey, John.
Yeah?
What are we doing?
What are we doing?
I don't know.
Hmm.
Remember when we had Maddie on?
I do.
I don't think she knew that was the name of the segment.
I don't think she did.
Okay.
I think she was in the dark for a lot of that.
Yeah.
I think she rolled with the punches, though.
You know, I think we should stop prefacing, you know, Here's a little bit of the process. Usually we set up our guest with like a few little tidbits about what the show is, because, you know, no one has listened to the show, except for you, dear listener. And so we usually give them like a heads up, hey, we're going to do this or that. I say we stop doing that.
Oh,
just throw them to the wolves.
Totally okay with that.
Because I had the most fun doing that to Maddie. It's like, now it's your turn to come up with a segment.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun.
I think it was. I like making the guests do some work.
Yeah. And if we like the segment enough, we can steal it and keep it.
Yeah, just like we now have Maddie's segment of segmented things. No, we don't.
Yeah, no. I don't think that one's gonna...
I don't like things with segments.
Because humans are non-segmented, except for our fingers.
And kind of our toes.
I don't have toes.
Well...
I mean, I do.
More your loss.
Oh.
Anyway. Man, I totally neglected to ask you how your day was.
Oh, it was fine. I have a job where nobody knows that we're open.
Nice. So you do the work for no one.
Well, no, I've been helping out one lady who I keep encouraging to come in just because it gives me something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it.
Yeah.
I work with one person on her nursing capstone.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the rest of the day, I edit our handbook.
Oh, that sounds...
I finished editing my handbook on the first day it was assigned to me.
Oh, I see.
It's a handbook for a writing center.
That can't be that long.
But also, there's not much to correct.
Yeah.
It's a writing center.
If you have people who work in a writing center wrote it, probably it's pretty all right.
There is one thing that I had to, like, circle, then scratch out, then write the word cut, because I just didn't like it so much.
Mm-hmm.
In our handbook, under the section that's called, Yep, It's a Job, which already has a certain level of passive-aggressive attitude toward it.
Yeah.
Is a sentence written in bold under the section outlining the desk duties, like, if you're working the desk.
Mm-hmm.
This is in bold. Typing and filing are not gender-specific jobs. And so I circled it, crossed it out, wrote the word cut, and then underneath that I wrote, it's 2016.
Yep.
We should not need this.
Even if you're doing it in like a passive-aggressive or tongue-in-cheek way, that's not necessary to put there.
Especially in bold.
Yep.
It's like, okay, maybe they had a problem in the past,
mm-hmm.
but most of the desk workers now are guys.
Yep.
We don't need to put this weird, like, oddly aggressive sentence in here.
Yeah, totally useless.
Yeah. It just, you know, all it does is make me bring up this conversation and be mad about it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've been thinking a lot about the internet.
Okay.
And, you know, the culture of offense we tend to find ourselves in.
You mean, yeah, the entire environment of today?
And I say we find ourselves in, but I actually feel like the culture of offense is maybe lessening to some degree.
How so?
I just see less of it, less genuine attempts at it. And I think that gets born out of when you do have these like groundswells of a certain kind of feeling. When they enter the realm of satire, people start to take them less seriously. And I certainly see more satire about being offended about everything than I once saw. I'm not saying it's necessarily good to make fun of this, because some people are very rightly offended by a lot of really unjust things that happen in the world.
I think, though, it returns back to a normal level where we're dealing with more of genuine things that need to be corrected,
mm-hmm.
rather than this weird explosion of outcries of offense,
mm-hmm.
where it's like, this offended me, now change it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the real thing about offense, I think as Stephen Fry puts it, It's like, you're offended, so what?
Mm-hmm.
If something offends you, you do have that right to be offended.
Mm-hmm.
That does not mandate a change of behavior.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I was, I guess, picturing when I was thinking about this is the culture of offense, and I'm not sure if that's a great way to put it. It's kind of anti-PC in a way. I don't like how it sounds.
Yeah.
But I feel like the huge amount of outcry against every potential offense in that concentrated amount was like, I don't know, it was like filling gaps. Okay, so let's say you have like this big flat plane and it's got gaps in it.
Okay.
Right? And those gaps are people who like need a voice but don't have one because society is like, oh, you haven't earned outrage. And I feel like the offense that people have registered has like washed over and filled in these gaps, but is largely like continued to wash over and isn't seen as much. And maybe people who felt like their outrage wouldn't before be valid are now much more comfortable being outraged about things that are outrageous.
Okay.
Like, more people can have louder voices about things that are actually fucked up than before this happened. So I think it's a good thing, for the most part.
It promoted people who might not have spoken up before to see, like, okay, people are outraged about something. I can't even think of something because I don't want to offend anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But they're outraged over something smaller, my thing that's much larger, I now feel more competent to step up and, like, bring to light.
And I think it's out of that was born, you know, well, I mean, I think largely the trans rights movement has gained so much ground over the last 5, 6, 7 years because of that.
Yeah,
but we are still standing under a shadow where we are actively afraid to offend people.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel like that fear on my part isn't entirely deserved because I don't mean anything by what I say, but I'm afraid that it will be misconstrued. If you're afraid to speak, even if you don't mean something bad, I think that's bad.
And this might just speak to the type of person I am, but I've gotten to the point where, like, I don't want to offend people because I don't want to face the backlash.
Exactly.
It's like, really and truly, I'm okay with offending people, mm-hmm. because that's just, you can't help but offend people sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know, we don't have, like, we're not taught a list of everything that could possibly offend someone.
Mm-hmm.
So we can avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
But the backlash these days, or days in our recent past, are just so huge. I mean, Joss Whedon had to quit Twitter.
Yeah.
He says it's not for that reason, but mm-hmm. it obviously was.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the backlash potential now is huge, maybe less huge than it was, and I do feel like, maybe this is me being totally selfish and saying, oh, if I feel, like, disenfranchised, if I feel frightened to speak my mind, even if I know in my heart I don't mean to hurt anyone, then yeah. I think that that's a negative thing, because, you know, the counter-argument to that is if you feel fear that you might hurt someone, it's because the thing that you're saying, like, you know, is rooted in something maybe incorrect, but I don't think that's right. Because I know that I don't harbor hate for people who I would say things to possibly offend.
And like, in the role of comedy, which we find ourselves in,
mm-hmm.
you know, more often than not, there's a difference between saying something and then, like, meaning it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, as a joke, I might say something, and if that offends somebody, and I don't actually believe it, but there's that same sort of backlash.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think comedians, like, ran into this a bunch on Twitter and platforms like that, where they would say a joke, and it would be misconstrued
mm-hmm.
into what they really believed, and even when they explained it was a joke, it was like, oh, now you're covering face.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like, no, just in comedy, you say things you don't believe in to elicit a response.
I mean, comedians are, for the most part, like astronauts of language. They're out there like poking at dark corners that other people aren't poking at, because the best way to get a legitimate response from a crowd or even yourself is to put together and string together like sentiments and words and noises in a way that's new. You know, laughter is a response to learning something new. You're just trying to like teach people things. You're trying to teach them like new perspectives to make them laugh.
Yeah.
So if you're out there like poking at the crevices of language, and you say an arrangement of words that you don't mean, but you know are funny, it's entirely possible that that will offend someone who had not been offended by that thing before. Comedians have always, throughout their history, been on this, like, bleeding edge of offense.
Yeah.
They've been on the fence of offense.
I mean, certainly you've got, like, the shock and awe kind of people, the people who are just trying to be shocking and surprising.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the people who, like, tone down. They're still surprising. They're not as gross or gratuitous as maybe the shock and awe types.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the really, really subtle people who seemingly are just pointing out things around us in a, mm-hmm. in a funny way. But they might trip on something and find, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's sticks and stones may break our bones, But words should never hurt us.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
I think comedy's an interesting creature, if we want to talk about that. Because it's you always have to exist on this edge of offending someone, because the closer you get to offending someone, the more, like, raw the reaction you get out of them is. You know, it's why crowd work is so good. It's why comedians can, like, tear someone apart in crowd work, and the person laughs at it and enjoys it, because you're, like, right on that edge of actually hurting someone's feelings.
Yeah.
But it's important to, as anyone who does comedy, never end up on the wrong side of history, and it's so easy to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Like, people, comedians throughout history just keep saying certain words that we now are not okay with. They make fun of people that we like now. And they did it because it got a reaction out of people, like a raw, visceral reaction. But if you chase that too much and you end up on the wrong side of history, you're, like, excommunicated from society. You're exiled. Because when anyone in the future looks back at your work, it's just disgusting.
Yeah.
Which, somehow, Eddie Murphy still exists, despite that weird homophobia stuff.
Well, I mean, he threw himself on the sword of Pluto Nash and just ended his career.
Pretty much. Or yeah. Meet Dave.
Yeah, one of those.
But when he did speak of it, he was like, yeah, I was dumb and stupid, I just wanted people to laugh, I didn't actually believe it.
Yeah.
Which anyone could say, but I don't think Eddie Murphy's a bad person. And I think he was on that edge. It's just that looking at it from our perspective now, he was on the wrong side of that fence. He was on the wrong side of history at that time.
I mean, it's kind of like politicians who will literally say anything to appeal to a crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll do weird things like adapt a tiny bit of a southern drawl when they're in their hometown or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, comedians, at the end of the day, want people to nod their head by laughing,
mm-hmm.
and politicians want people to nod their head by voting. We just want people to agree with us.
You know, we just want that rush that, I think I may have talked about this on the podcast, but Patton Oswalt talks about it. It's like, you know, there's a drug that anyone who performs regularly gets, and it is, you say something, there's silence, and then there's a reaction. And that's, it releases endorphins in your blood. You go crazy for it.
It becomes addictive, mm-hmm. because if you can, like, get this really good feel-good reaction again and again, you're going to want to chase that comedy dragon.
I'm not a huge fan of being with a bunch of people, generally speaking, but I love performing because I love making people laugh. It's this huge, visceral, positive reaction for me that makes me feel high.
It's all fun and games until the final applause happens, and then it's just like, yeah, I'm going to be at the bar. You can come talk if you want, but, like, one at a time?
Yep.
Because there's, like, a swarm of people. It's just like, I want to be anywhere else.
I want to be alone for a minute.
So I was just in front of 200 faces. Come on. Let me sit in my booth.
I mean, we're not a huge comedy thing.
Yeah, I said 200. It's more like 60.
I mean, we've performed in front of decently sized audiences.
Yeah,
like,
we have.
You know. But there's this thing where if we have, like, a really good performance in front of a lot of people, I'll, like, step away from the stage, like, my hands are shaking, and I feel really unpleasant.
Yeah.
But when I was on stage, I felt great.
And it's worse when people walk up to you and they're like, man, that was such a good job, and you're like, I don't remember anything I've done for the past 2 hours.
Yeah, I have no idea what just happened.
Yeah.
I basically entered a fugue state.
Do I know you?
It's like the needle entered my arm and I blacked out and I woke up in the post show.
So yeah, I mean, I think as like a final little word on this offense thing, I don't know. I don't want to say try to develop a thicker skin, but and when you're in the business of comedy, any sort of entertainer, writer, what have you, any sort of business where you can be critiqued,
mm-hmm.
and that's pretty much all businesses. Because your work performances and such,
mm-hmm.
evaluations. But, like, you're going to need a thicker skin in the real world because people do not pull punches. Give anyone a little bit of power and they will run a mile all over your body.
I mean, going back to the Stephen Fry thing, they have a right to be offended and they have a right to tell you they're offended, but it doesn't warrant a change in behavior.
Yeah. I'm not saying don't be offended, I'm not saying don't express your offense, but don't expect things to change just because you're offended.
Mm-hmm. And if you're a creator, don't necessarily change because you offended someone.
Yeah.
It goes both ways.
I mean, the thing I'll say about that is, like, if you are truly sort of, I don't want to say ignorant, but unaware of why what you did was offensive, and you do research and you realize, okay, like, my intention was to do this one thing, but now I've realized I've stumbled on this like, real hornet's nest of a problem, then you can change.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's just because, hey, most of your fan base is offended, then it's like, well, maybe I intended to offend them. Maybe that's the response I was going for.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's all that needs to be said on that subject for right now.
Yeah.
It's a subject we could talk about for a while.
Pretty much.
We both feel pretty strongly about it.
I mean, yeah. I don't look at articles of stuff in my spare time and just be like, man, I really hate the world. That's not what I do. I do constructive things.
I like to think we all do that first one.
Probably.
I do think it's important, though, like you said, if you're ignorant, to research. I find myself doing that more often than not, where if I do offend someone and I don't know why I offended them, I need to find out why. Then usually when I find out why, it's either like, oh, they had a right to be offended, but it's not bad, or, oh, I was completely in the wrong for doing that.
Yeah.
And then your behavior can change.
Always do the research.
Mm-hmm.
And don't trust people on internet forums or Facebook comments. You know, do the research yourself.
Can we make that a facet of Zero Credits?
That we
always do the research? Not us, clearly.
Yeah.
But we must always advise our audience, always do the research. It's always worth it to research.
I mean, that's the thing about Zero Credits. We are openly admitting that we don't really know much about things, but we're not insanely proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
We're just presenting a perspective of a person who doesn't have the credentials to get, like, a real talk show.
And I think because of Zero Credits, I do more research on topics that are maybe pertinent to people everywhere.
Yeah, I mean,
this is just a growth chart. Zero Credits is like a growth chart for us. It's just us expressing opinions that we're not qualified to express, and we're just getting better at it and more qualified as time goes on.
Yeah, I mean, one day we're going to get to one credit, and then we'll change the show, and it'll be just an AM radio show with a soundboard, and then we'll have dumb contests, like, can you catch this hot dog in your mouth? And then we'll get rich and famous. But until then, we'll be Zero Credits, the intellectual pursuers of research to knowledge.
And together, we're Henry and John.
Yeah.
Want to take a break?
You want to catch this hot dog in your mouth?
Nope.
All right, let's take a break.
Okay. Say hello to my little friend. I'm British. I had a birthday.
We're not in the podcast.
I'm just letting you know.
I know you did yesterday. I wish you.
I had a birthday.
I wish you.
It did well.
I wish you.
Thank you. I got someone bought me an icy. Hey there, Henry.
Oh, hi, John.
Do you like TV?
Oh, man, do I.
Well, do I have the TV for you?
Okay, cool.
It's called the BBC.
The BBC?
It's like regular television, but made by different people.
What? That's insane.
You like Law & Order, right?
Okay, maybe.
Imagine if Law & Order had Sherlock Holmes in it.
Whoa!
You like Law & Order, right?
Sure.
Imagine if Law & Order had a time-traveling British guy in it.
Man!
You like Law & Order, right?
No.
Imagine if they reviewed a lot of cars on Law & Order, and then they went to a bunch of different countries, and they were like, oh, don't blame me.
That sounds like a completely different show.
It was great.
Okay. I like it.
Good.
The BBC, you say?
The British
Broadcasting
Channel.
Okay.
That's probably what it stands for.
I'm guessing.
What other shows do you like?
Oh, I like Law & Order.
You like Law & Order?
Yeah.
What if Law & Order was set in a fancy house, and it had upstairs people and downstairs people?
Oh, man, that sounds interesting.
Was that on PBS?
No.
Good. What if you liked Law & Order?
I might.
What if Law & Order follow me on this one.
I'll try.
Was actually the news.
Okay.
But it was hosted by British people who told you all the bad things that happened, but with a British voice.
Man, that would take the edge off of some things.
How do you like shows with less production values than you're used to?
I like them.
How do you like people who like things a lot, probably more than you like them?
Maybe.
How do you like watching shows with the knowledge that a lot of people care way more about these shows than you possibly could, making it hard to watch them? The BBC!
It's like Law and Order,
but British!
Welcome back to the podcast.
I'm John.
And I'm Henry. We're not doing this again. Why?
Fuck.
We don't introduce ourselves when we come back from a break.
Okay.
But I'm Henry.
Ah, vaporwave.
Hey, John.
What's up?
I don't think I got to ask.
Yes?
How was your day?
It was good. I walked around a lot and it was hot.
Good.
And then I read a lot about vaporwave.
Vaporwave?
We don't need to talk about...
Google Vaporwave.
Or, you know what, if you're listening to this, you probably know vaporwave. What it's about. It is way too late to get into vaporwave.
As an ironical thing, could I do, like, vape nash, but I'm actually talking about vaporwave and not vaping?
What is nash?
Nation.
Oh, vape nash.
Vape nation?
Wait.
It's the nation of people who
what
vape.
What if you opened a vape shop?
Yeah,
but it was just vaporwave.
And, like, it's all just, like, displays of vaporwave songs, and I'm like, yeah, you can have that for a dollar.
They sit in stools and, like, look at vaporwave songs.
Yeah, I'll rent out the stool. I'll be like, you get 15 minutes to sit in our custom stool,
mm-hmm.
And you will partake.
Nice. So, you know, that made me think.
Oh, wow. Are you thinking?
Yeah.
Man.
You know what I was thinking?
What were you thinking?
About what did you watch? So, what'd you watch?
Oh, we're starting with me this week.
No, I'll start. I watched this movie called Bringing Out the Dead.
Ooh.
It's a Nicolas Cage.
Monty Python.
Nope.
Oh.
It's a Martin Scorsese movie.
Ah, Scorsese.
Screenplay adapted by, I want to say, like, Paul Schrader, I think.
Oh, that guy who writes all the really good movies?
Yeah.
Is that the guy I'm thinking of?
No, he
writes lots of good movies.
It's adapted from this book by Joe Connolly, I think his name is. It's about a hollow-eyed EMT.
Oh, so like a cynical EMT?
It's an EMT who has failed to save someone in months, and can no longer sleep, has developed a serious drinking problem.
Wait, when you say failed to save someone in months, that means, like, every call he goes to, someone dies? Or
yes.
Jesus!
Yes.
That's horrible.
Yeah. So, Nicolas Cage is the EMT in question. Patricia Arquette is this ex-junkie girl who he has a thing for.
Okay.
In a really... Nicolas Cage... very convincing performance, as he is super manic all of the time. Patricia Arquette kind of phones it in.
Okay.
But I'm not a huge Patricia Arquette fan.
So you're saying this is one of the Nicolas Cage films in which Nicolas Cage is performing well?
Yeah. He does a good job. I think it's a good movie. But Nicolas Cage, Patricia Arquette, John Goodman? John Goodman's in it.
I love John Goodman.
He's pretty good. Ving Rhames is in it.
I don't know who that is.
He was in the remake of Dawn of the Dead.
Man, that's a movie.
Yeah, it is. Have you seen it?
No.
Oh, it's all right.
I didn't do horror for a really long time.
That's fair. But it's got Ving Rhames, Tom Sizemore, a bunch of people are in it.
More like and, size less.
Haha, because he's fat. What? Anyway, he is more size.
Yeah.
But really interesting movie to watch. It really makes me think that maybe something really awful was happening in Martin Scorsese's life at the time that he was directing this movie.
Yeah, because Scorsese's the guy who... well, legendarily take 217 takes to do the same mm-hmm. shot to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Does this movie have that kind of, like, energy underneath it?
The thing about Scorsese movies, generally speaking, is they have this kind of restrained, artful energy. Like, even things like Taxi Driver, they feel bursting with energy, but they feel restrained. They feel like they're within reality.
Yeah.
This movie's like a fever dream.
Oh, man.
This movie's insane. The The interplay with light in this movie is insane because there are maybe two scenes with natural light.
Oh, wow.
All the other scenes take place in a night so dark that all the scenes look almost like velvet paintings, that they're painted on these really rich darks.
That's interesting.
And all the colors are blown out. And one of the ways I described it when I was watching it is that a lot of the scenes feel like you're like looking under a rock and shining a flashlight and you're seeing things that you weren't meant to see in light.
Okay.
Like people just scurry through like mist filled hot streets. And there's this, they keep playing with the mirrors and windows and windshields in the ambulance, like how light will play off of it. And there's one scene where I think it's Tom Sizemore is driving the ambulance, and the way that the street lights and the lights from neon signs are playing off of the windshield looks almost like he's traveling through like hyperspace.
That's really interesting. It's,
the light in this movie is a hell of a thing, and it is a disgusting looking movie. Like it's not enjoyable to look at. It makes you feel hungover.
Wow.
It's very manic and hot and aggressive and grungy. It's really good.
I mean, it sounds like they put a lot of thought into the visual aspect of this film.
It's a beautiful movie. It's also very surreal.
Okay.
It almost borders on being like a magic realism kind of thing.
Okay.
Where you have characters saying things that actually, well, yeah, it is magic realism. There's a virgin birth in it.
Oh, wow.
One of the great things about setting a movie in this like autobiographical world of an EMT is that he keeps going to these little vignettes of humanity, being involved in them, and then like pulling back and not being part of them anymore. Which,
yeah.
From what I understand, EMT's lives are basically that way anyway.
I mean, you're an emergency responder. You're only there in that person's life for the duration of the emergency, really.
Yeah, the only time you show up as an EMT is for the very short time where everything is bad. You see the entire tableau of their life, like a Renaissance painting or something, and then you're gone.
You see none of, like, the good of it, really. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you just see what they need an emergency responder for, which is never a good thing.
And that seems like it might easily break a person if they don't have a good call,
mm-hmm.
you know, once in months.
Mm-hmm. And Nick Cage plays it pretty convincingly. He looks awful in the movie. They do a great job of making him look like he hasn't slept in weeks. It's real good.
Bringing out the dead?
Bringing out the dead. Wow. It was a critical success, but a box office flop.
Well, that happens a lot.
Yeah. Which, there are moments in it that are so strange. Like, dialogue choices. There are even editing choices that boggle the mind. Like, he's having a conversation with Patricia Arquette's character, and there's this odd, stilted pause in the conversation, and then it makes these three laborious fade cuts around her face that take, like, 5 to 7 seconds to complete before the conversation resumes.
That's weird.
Watching the movie feels like you haven't been sleeping in a long time.
Which might be an intended effect, because it seems like Nicolas Cage is in this weird state of sleepless delirium.
Mm-hmm. In a lesser movie, this entire movie would be a drug trip.
Gotcha.
Also, it plays with the cyclical nature of his life. Like, you see when he keeps going back to this Our Mother of Mercy hospital, which they call Misery.
Of course.
And he keeps going back to this place that they call Misery, which you could say this is maybe a movie about purgatory or hell if you wanted to make a stretch. But you see him go in, and almost every time he goes in, you see that things are being, like, put back into the position they were when he first came in. Like, there's a character played by Mark Anthony who keeps demanding a drink of water. He's a junkie. And the first time he goes there, Mark Anthony is in one position, like, begging for a drink of water. It's a very chaotic thing. And then one of the next times he goes by, they wheel Mark Anthony's character right back into the same spot, and Mark Anthony repeats the exact same lines of dialogue he said the last time.
Wow, that can get trippy.
It's a very trippy movie.
Yeah.
It, really weird, beautiful scenes. Soundtrack is all over the place. Like, some real nice soft rock and, like, legitimate punk music. One of the best things in the movie, at least the thing that hooked me originally, was they tie this, like, wailing saxophone from this jazz song to the flashing lights of the ambulance.
Whoa.
So whenever the ambulances are on screen, it's during the wailing saxophone parts.
That's...
And it makes it... it pairs the wailing of an ambulance siren with the wailing of that saxophone in a really great way.
That's really cool.
It's a good movie.
Yeah.
It's,
it sounds good.
It's interesting because it doesn't even have a cult following. I'd never even heard of it until I watched it.
I haven't heard of it either.
It was a huge surprise to me.
I mean, it's got a title like Walk Among the Tombstones, which was, and you know, from the title sounds like a good movie,
mm-hmm.
but then it turns out the movie is really bad.
Oh, yeah.
So Bringing Out the Dead,
mm-hmm.
really great title,
mm-hmm.
which to me means the film must be terrible.
I'd really be interested to get your take on the movie. I think you'd like it as someone who likes weird, bleak things.
I mean, yeah, that's me.
And weird things on the edge of, like, surreality.
Yeah.
I think it would be up your alley.
Cool.
Keep in mind, there's a lot about the movie I didn't like. I can totally overlook it for being, like, this concrete creative vision.
What year did it come out?
99.
So it's old.
I mean, 17 years old, but yes.
There's a weird thing about movies from, like, a different time period. I don't know if it's the sound quality, the video quality, or whatever, but they all have a very distinct feel
mm-hmm.
of being from, compared to now, a different era.
I mean, definitely late 90s films
yeah.
have this, and I think it really contributes to Bringing Out the Dead's, like, grungy, gross feeling, is a lot of late 90s American movies just felt, like, gross and fast and green and neon.
I don't know if it's just, like, the weird, you know, the sudden transition into high definition,
mm-hmm.
but it seems like standard definition, if that's what we call it, but whatever came before in comparison is more muddled
mm-hmm.
with, like, artifacts and things,
mm-hmm.
you know, the visual artifacts that can just lend that sort of feeling to a piece.
Mm-hmm.
And if that piece is already kind of dealing with the filth of humanity or whatever,
mm-hmm.
then it just benefits. It's great.
And I think a lot of movies made before the turn of the millennium feel almost perverse. I feel like the Matrix actually is a great example of how movies can feel really baroque and perverse in a weird way. Like they're very singular and creative and fast and unforgiving. And I feel like in the 2000s we pulled that back a lot. Movies became a lot smaller, a lot more humble, a lot quieter.
I mean, the Matrix is a really good example of watching that sort of transition happen.
Because
mm-hmm. the first one was very, like, come on. He sells illegal tech or something to, like, what seems like drug dealers, you mm-hmm. know. It's grungy. It's like, the visuals are more muddled and dirty.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you compare it to the last film, where, spoilers, but whatever, where Neo is fighting just 1,000 Agent Smiths,
mm-hmm.
everything is clear.
Yep.
Pristine. Because if there had that weird, muddled, muddy filter over it,
mm-hmm.
we wouldn't be able to make out all the overblown action.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that trilogy kind of missed out on something from transitioning to better technology.
I mean, I think the first Matrix had it within it. And I'll say this to my grave, that the first Matrix is a great, great, great movie and had so much promise. And I feel like the Matrix could have become this almost anthology of cyberpunk Superman movies. That it could have explored this really interesting gross world in great ways, and it really failed to do that.
Yeah.
It just turned into an anime, basically.
Pretty much.
And not a good anime, either.
Well, you're right. It had a good anime fight in it.
It did. It had some great anime fights, some of which were stolen almost directly from Dragon Ball Z, but whatever.
I mean, great writers steal, John. Great writers steal.
You're right. Thanks, Wachowskis.
Yeah, Wachowskis. I heard one of them pulled out a Sense 8 recently.
Mm-hmm. I heard Sense 8's really good.
I've heard mixed messages.
I've heard it's really good for enough people that I want to check it out, but every time I try, it's like, man, this show is so far up its own ass.
Yeah. But so anyway, Walk Among the Tombstones. I mean to say, Bringing Out the Dead,
mm-hmm.
starring Nicolas Cage.
And Patricia Arquette.
And Patricia Arquette.
And Tom Sizemore, John Goodman,
directed,
Mark Anthony, Ving Rhames.
Directed by Martin Scorsese.
Nailed it.
Whew.
Written by Paul Schrader. Well, screenplay adapted by Paul Schrader.
From a Joe Connolly.
Mm-hmm. Makes you want to read the book.
Probably should.
But, speaking of reading a book...
No.
Oh, speaking of a movie?
No.
Speaking of things I saw with my eyes.
Speaking of something I saw with my eyes.
What did you watch?
I watched all 40 episodes of Gravity Falls.
Oh, that's a good show.
In a single day.
Is that possible?
Yep.
Are they 30 minutes?
Yep.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of time.
That's a lot of time.
Whew, I didn't say I was proud of it, but Gravity Falls. For those of you who have never heard of this, it is a cartoon, started on Disney Channel, ended on Disney XD, which is like a different channel.
What is the difference?
The difference is that on Disney XD, because it is not part of the normal cable package, you have more leeway.
Oh, so it's like FX.
Kind of. It's kind of like the difference between FX and FXX.
Oh, is FXX even more extreme?
Pretty much.
Man, I need to get that. Also cable.
So Gravity Falls is a story of a pair of twins who are 12 at the beginning of the show, and they're spending the summer with their uncle.
Do they age?
By the end of the show, they do.
I love aging people in shows. Anyway.
Yeah, time passes during the show normally.
I love that!
But they're spending the summer with their uncle in this town called Gravity Falls. It's in Wash, Oregon? The Pacific Northeast.
All right. Northwest.
That's what I meant. Okay. Because there is no specific
I'm in the Pacific Northeast. What the fuck? Does that mean like a Dakota?
I guess. The Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
I never learned cardinal direction.
That's fine.
So, you know, lots of forest, lots of woods. And so you think, oh man, this kid, he's going to have a really boring summer. His uncle runs like this weird mystery shack tourist trap, you know? Like you're on a road trip and you see like billboards for the world's biggest ball of yarn or something.
Mm-hmm.
So he runs a little tourist trap like that, where he says to have, like, all the mysteries of the universe. And but it turns out he's a con artist, you know? Mm-hmm. He like, glues a snake head to a baby. Not a baby. he glues, like, a duck and a beaver together and calls it a new creature. It's like, ooh, what is it? Well, it turns out in this little town of Gravity Falls, the supernatural exists.
Oh, does so, it?
Yeah.
Oh,
for
okay.
Real. In the first episode, they run into a bunch of gnomes.
Nice.
Just like a huge kingdom of gnomes.
I'm a big booster for gnomes in supernatural things.
And yeah, they run into lots of things like lake monsters and old men. You know, supernatural you old know, men.
Supernatural old men. What's the tone of the show like? Is it...
The tone is interesting. Because it's got, like, a very lighthearted front that coats a dark and almost sinister core.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, a lot of the times with the supernatural, it's like, man, everything's great, everything's wonderful. But this show really revels in the fact that even if the supernatural existed, people would not want to know.
Mm-hmm.
People would be frightened to their core. It would change them to know that the supernatural exists.
That's a very adult thing for this show to be covering.
The only ones who kind of, like, can handle it, of course, are kids.
Hmm.
Who are, like, very innocent, open-minded. They can handle the possibilities of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The adults, however, are, like, terrified and, like, cannot deal.
Mm-hmm.
The first season is all sort of more lighthearted. It's kind of like coming-of-age story episodes. Life lessons being handed out left and right. The second season becomes more serious.
Is that when it switched channels?
That's when it switched channels.
Okay.
So they were dealing with less censorship. There was still a lot of censorship.
It's still a Disney property.
And then how this worked was the first season is 20 episodes. The second season is 17 episodes. And then they went on a hiatus. And the last three episodes are all one multi-part finale.
Okay.
And ooh, the series gets darker and darker to, I'm going to say a line from the, like, last episode of the series.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a line that got me to watch the show. A person says, I have some children I need to turn into corpses.
Oh.
This isn't a kid's cartoon.
Nice. That's
what got me to watch the show.
That's pretty dark.
Because the creator, whose name is, like, Alex Hirsch, I don't know how to spell it.
Mm.
He fought to include this really dark tone this really kind of like sinister underbelly to the lighthearted nature of the show, mm-hmm. because that's life. Mm-hmm. And also because it's just the way he wanted it to happen. And sprouted throughout the entire show, of course, there's a lot of twin stuff. Alex Hirsch has a twin whose name is Alexa.
Alexa Hirsch?
It's Ariel.
Okay.
But it's, you know, twin names, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But apparently they must have been into, like, cryptology or something, because there are cryptographs everywhere in this show.
Oh.
At the end of every episode, there is a cryptograph that... If you know anything about, like, ciphers or anything like that, you can solve these messages and like, spell them out and, like, get the secret messages. And I was like, I knew of all those because I could see them at the end of the credits every time. Well, it turns out in the show itself, there are cryptographs just hidden.
That's very cool.
It's really awesome.
I love hidden shit.
Yeah. And, you know, for those of you who don't want to work it out like me, someone has done it for you.
Mm-hmm.
There are like messages you can read.
I was going to say, that sounds like the kind of thing that's very fascinating that thankfully the internet will already have done for me.
But and one of the best messages that people like tuned in on too early was so the uncle's name, they call their great uncle. They call him Grunkle, which I believe is the most adorable name.
That's a pretty good name.
They call him Grunkle Stan, and one of the ciphers at the end of, one of the early episodes says, Stan is not what he seems.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to watch the series to figure out what that means.
Does it turn out he's not what he seems?
Kinda.
Okay. Is he a dragon?
No. There are no dragons.
I thought you said this show dealt with the supernatural, Henry.
Well, it's more like the the American supernatural, like werewolves, zombies, the undead, gnomes. Those aren't all American, but
still, I think they exist, like, you know, at the forefront of like American mythology or cryptology, cryptozoology.
And, you know, it's not quite Over the Garden Wall, where it's steeped in a certain genre of something. Like, Over the Garden Wall is very much, like, Germanic folktale, stuff like that. This is more of just a general grasp of the supernatural.
It sounds like much more diffuse than something like Over the Garden Wall. It sounds like it deals with many more ideas and less of a central idea than Gravity Falls does. Not Gravity Falls. Over the Garden Wall.
Over the Garden Wall.
That's what I meant to say.
But, yeah, season one is definitely sort of like proof of concept. It's like, if we're going to be on Disney, we have to sort of focus on, like, these growing pains, these having a twin problems, these having a crush who's 3 years older, you're 12, she's 15, it could never work problems.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that, and mixed in is obviously like a love letter to Alex's sister, who is apparently boy crazy, but girls of a certain age do become weirdly obsessed with boys, so like Mabel, who is the twin in the show, kind of goes through like these weird mishaps with liking guys who always turn out to be supernatural entities.
What?
Yeah.
I can almost piece this together from context clues, but how's the writing?
Writing's great.
All right.
It's really funny.
I look forward to that. I say that because I'm going to watch it all now.
You should.
How many seasons are there?
2 seasons.
Oh, is that it?
2 seasons.
Nice. So 20 episodes apiece?
Yeah, so 40 episodes total.
Man, that's a lot, though.
That is a lot.
That's not a short show.
I wouldn't recommend watching it all in one sitting.
I'll watch maybe half of the first one.
Oh, yeah.
Tonight.
I mean, I didn't sit down and watch it all. Sometimes I was walking, like, on a treadmill.
Okay, that'll help.
Only I don't own a treadmill.
So you're just walking?
Walked around my couch.
Nice.
Yeah.
That explains why there's a hole worn in the floor.
Yeah, kinda.
That was a fruitful what did you watch?
Yeah.
Feel like we both had a lot of ideas to discuss.
That was the first time in a long time that I've actually had something for What Did You Watch?
Well, you know, life makes fools of us all.
I'm a fool for not watching more things?
Yep. Consume.
I will. In fact, I'll consume so much, we'll have to do a supplemental reading after this episode.
What?
That's right. We're going to do a supplemental reading
after this episode.
After this episode.
So you're going to have a double dose of listening entertainment.
Some bonus content that may, once we discuss it, not actually release the same week.
Maybe. Mm. But if we want to get to that supplemental reading, I guess we better get out of this normal podcast.
But first...
Yes?
We have some time.
Some obligations to our listeners.
Yeah, we can't just jet and then run off and make more content for you. We have to wrap up our obligations first, and our obligation is to give you a good podcast.
You deserve your money's worth from this podcast.
Exactly. We don't know how much money our podcast is worth.
The donations have been rolling in.
Wait, we can do donations?
Yeah. What if we set up a Patreon? Let's talk about Patreon for a second.
Oh my god,
how do we make one?
You have to produce a product.
Done.
On a semi-consistent basis.
Done.
And you have to promise that some of the money that you make goes back into making the product.
Absolutely.
Now, the people who pay us or donate to us, they get perks.
Okay.
Like, they get something special that the free people wouldn't get.
Oh.
And you could do, like, a thing where it's, like, per month they get something or per post. So if we did per post, that would be, like, 4 special somethings a month.
Okay.
I don't know what we could do that would be special.
We could have a segment of our podcast where we just talk about how great these people are.
We could, but that's kind of annoying.
Yeah, you're right.
Or we could do, like, a thing where it's, like, donator of the moment, where it's, like, maybe we pick one of them at random and, like, send them, like, interview questions via email.
Mm.
And then, like, it's kind of like we're having them as a special guest for a segment.
Okay.
We could do something like that.
Okay, we could do that.
This actually sounds like something that's plausible.
I mean, we do need to make money.
Money would be nice.
Eating is hard.
I had John buy me food today.
Yeah.
It was Taco Bell.
Look.
I haven't had Taco Bell in, like, 4 years.
Don't be too precious.
My stomach's being torn apart from the inside.
I have Taco Bell at least every day.
And look at you now.
Where are my teeth?
Where are your teeth?
But, yeah, maybe a Patreon is something we could do.
That would be something we would both need to research.
That seems hard.
We just told our audience to do the research.
You're right. I can't.
We can stand to do a little research, especially if there's all the money to gain.
I can't be a baby about this now.
You know, the more we talk about getting paid and having money, the more the more unflattering this is.
You're right.
People don't want to give people money. People don't want to give people money!
I think that's a good rule of the universe. Yeah. I think Patreon stuff like it is good, though.
Yeah, I kind of like the per-month model more than the per-post model.
Because
I think per-post means, like, you would even charge per-post. Like,
oh,
they would donate per-post, and that seems kind of egregious since we are going to post one a week anyway.
Yeah.
So maybe a per-month thing would be better.
I'm not sure I feel comfortable charging people for things. I guess they're just perks, though.
Well, it's like, here's the thing. It's supposed to be donations, so it's not technically charging, but that's totally what it is. It's a business transaction.
Yeah. See, that I wonder about things like Patreon, because it's supposed to be ushering in this idea of, you know, this new age of having patrons.
Yeah.
Patrons of the arts.
It's harking back to the Renaissance when the rich would literally fund the artist.
But in the Renaissance, the Renaissance, if you will.
Is that really how people pronounce it?
Some people do. I say Renaissance.
Renaissance.
I say Renaissance. But
good riddance.
Did they necessarily stand to make a profit from patronage?
It did not seem like it.
So, I don't know.
Patrons, I mean, you would dictate what they painted, what the artist painted, and then it was really just for your own gain. Like, it would be like, I now have this portrait of myself that I can hang in my foyer, or something like that.
Maybe there's a new way or a different way we could go about this, where artists are patronized, but it's a cleaner, less business-like transaction.
Indentured servitude.
Exactly. No.
No.
No, we're already slaves to ourselves.
We're slaves to our craft.
You're right.
The podcast life is such a harsh life.
It is. I was raised by my father to be a podcast, and his father before him was a podcast.
Wait, you were raised by your father to just be a podcast?
Yeah, I'm WTF with Marc Maron.
Wow.
Rips off skin.
And turns into a podcast.
Yes, I disappear.
Into waveform.
Vaporwave.
Do, 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 do. None of those songs are copyrighted, right?
Okay, we're gonna get sued. Hey, parody.
Fair use.
Fair use.
Which turns out, that's a defense you use in court, meaning you have to go to court where your defense may not stand.
That'll stand.
That is not a protected thing. That is an argument you make as your side of a court case.
Don't sue us. What about parody? There's parody law.
Parody law is a thing.
Yeah.
Are we directly parodying a single title?
Yeah.
Are we? That's just recreation.
You're right.
Anyway.
Hey, no one's paying us for this. We're not making a profit off of it.
You're right.
You're so right.
The weird cyclical nature of podcast law.
Can't sue us, podcast law.
Da 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 da.
I'm a podcast lawyer.
Now we're gonna get sued.
Great. I look forward to it.
Oh, the day that they take 0 credits to court is the day that we bring a recording device to the court case.
That would be amazing.
And make it into an episode.
Boy, we'd go to double prison.
Yep.
We just have like an Arduino board and we're like, okay, at this time, just post it to the website.
If I get sent to jail, post this to the website.
We just like touch our lapel pins.
Together. Yeah. So it's like really obvious we're doing something awkward.
What are you doing?
We're saying goodbye to each other.
Also, why?
I'm British.
I like to imagine we're both like in the defendant's chair together, like doing the weird lapel pin thing.
We didn't call you both up. It's like, we're a dynamic duo.
This is the people versus the people?
The people.
The people versus 0 credits.
The people's court hates us and they are bringing us to trial.
All people are against us.
Man, your guys are going to get your 25 cents. A compliant? No.
What?
Complainant?
What?
Like a class action lawsuit? You?
Oh, right,
you
yeah.
get more people so they get more clout, but then it turns out like the payout is like $1.
Yep. Yeah, my parents were in a class action lawsuit that's like, oh, sweet, 13 cents. You can go fuck off.
This is the perfect amount of money to go fuck off.
Any more or less, and you couldn't go fuck off, but...
Really earning that explicit tag.
All you need to fuck off is 13... You don't need no credit card to fuck off this train, but you do need 13 cents.
13 cents. This episode brought to you by 13 cents.
No more, no less.
Fuck off.
Great.
That probably filled it.
That's probably fine.
All right.
And that's what a strong finish.
Man. So, contact us.
If you want to get in contact with us like no one chose to do this week, if you want to write an email that we'll read and then do our thing with it, it's 0creditsisapodcast@gmail.com. One word.
Yeah, of course. There's no spaces in email addresses.
What if there are underscores?
It's 0podcast. God! 0creditsisapodcast@gmail.com. All lowercase.
All lowercase.
All one word.
All one word.
No spaces.
No spaces.
Because it's an email address.
Yes.
And if writing an email gives you pause, because it's like writing an essay, you can write just a response to a short answer question on Twitter at ZCPCWHJ.
0 credits podcast with Henry John is what that stands for.
Is that like your little thing?
Yeah.
You do that every episode?
Yep.
ZCPCWHJ, you know, I realize Twitter apparently isn't big in this area for some reason.
Really?
It just doesn't seem to take off as much as I want it to.
I don't know a lot of people who tweet.
I know, just me.
Maybe we should have an Instagram. I know a lot of people who gram.
Alright, I pitched you an Instagram, and you were like, no, what? I don't want that.
How's a podcast supposed to have pictures?
Who am I supposed to be? WTF with Mark Mirren? No. Mm. We are 0 credits, and I am John. Wait. And I've got tears in my eyes now because this Instagram thing has got me so emotional.
Remember all that time ago, that long, long time ago when I said that, what do you want me to be, WTF with Mark Maron?
Yeah.
Hail Hydra.
Oh, God.
He's turning into a podcast.
A podcast with many heads. And also Nazis.
Is Hydra Nazis?
Hydra's Nazis?
I guess.
0 credits.
0 credits. Like, comment, and subscribe. Also,
don't hate us.
Please don't.
Because we're beautiful.
If you do hate us, that's your right.
Because we're
ugly. But don't expect us to change.
Bye!
Bye!